Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are talking about what we can learn from countries where abortion is illegal. Life for women in the United States living in Republican-controlled states like Texas and Oklahoma was pretty bad before Donald Trump. It was very difficult when it comes to reproductive justice, but it's about to get much worse. In January, an Indiana Republican lawmaker plans to introduce a bill that would outlaw and criminalize all forms of abortion. Last week, Planned Parenthood and its allies filed lawsuits in Alaska, Missouri, and North Carolina against a 20-week ban on abortion. And in a few weeks, Texas will require aborted fetuses to be buried or cremated. The victory of Donald Trump, coupled with a Republican-controlled Congress and the vacancy on the Supreme Court, is raising alarms about the future of Roe v. Wade, the 1973 landmark decision that legalized abortion. So here we are at the end of 2016, talking about what we can learn from women who work in countries where abortion is currently illegal. In Ireland, a constitutional ban on abortion means that only women whose pregnancies put their lives at risk can have access to safe, legal abortion services. But abortion is not permitted in cases of fatal abnormalities. Abortion is also illegal in most countries in South America. Today, we are joined by Françoise Gerard, president of the International Women's Health Coalition, an organization that works to advance the sexual and reproductive health and rights of women and girls around the globe. Hi, Françoise. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Thank you. We're also joined by Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of Rewire, a nonprofit daily online publication focusing on sexual and reproductive health, rights, and justice. Hi, Jody. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. How are you? Hi, Françoise.
Hi, Jody.
Well, it's great to have both of you. Jody, so much is happening so quickly, and in Indiana, a Republican lawmaker plans to introduce a bill that would outlaw and criminalize all forms of abortion next month. We're already in December. Do you think that anti-choice politicians across the country have become even more empowered with Donald Trump about to take office?
Well, there's no question about that, and I think it's primarily because you've got Mike Pence as vice president. You know, my feeling is that many of the decisions that are being made as to things like HHS and in other parts of the government are actually coming from Pence more than Trump, because Trump has little to no experience in these things. And this is like a kid in a candy store for Mike Pence, who wants to literally strip people of their health rights across the board. He presided over a state where women were imprisoned for miscarriages, where HIV ran rampant because he refused to fund HIV prevention because he considers it immoral, and also where the infant mortality rate is quite high and the maternal mortality rate among Black women is quite high. So I think, you know, more than anything, we are going to see Mike Pence's and the anti-choice movements fingerprints all over this administration, and I suspect that people in Indiana, the ones that you're talking about right now who are looking forward to this bill, are queuing up their legislative actions for courts that they hope will be more in their favor.
When Republicans took back Congress after the 2010 Tea Party wave, Mike Pence authored a bill to defund Planned Parenthood, completely removing all federal funding from the organization. And he was asked if he would go as far as to shut down the government over it. He said, quote, "Of course I am. As a governor in Indiana," he backed and signed bills, as you mentioned. And Jody, this didn't get much attention at all during the campaign season. A lot of people still don't know where Mike Pence stands on these issues.
It did not, and it's another failure of the media, that the larger media, that this was not reported effectively and accurately. This is a dangerous man. He comes across, you know, I heard many a media anchor talking about Mike Pence as, quote, a decent guy. He comes across as this sort of, you know, aw shucks, nice guy, pleasant, polite. Those are words that you hear ascribed to him. He's an extremely dangerous man, and I am not being, I'm not overreacting here. This is a man who does not believe that gay people have the right to be who they are, who supports, you know, gay conversion therapy, whose state is one of the worst in terms of indicators of both economic and public health indicators, and who is very willing to do things like, you know, defund Planned Parenthood, thereby leaving literally millions of people who depend on Planned Parenthood for essential primary health care without access to that health care. And to him, it's really just another day at work.
That is Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of Rewire. We're also joined by Françoise Gérard, president of the International Women's Health Coalition. Françoise, 10, 15 years ago, you did not get Republicans going on the record saying that they opposed abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. And now it's become very common. As you just heard, an Indiana Republican lawmaker plans to introduce a bill next month that would outlaw and criminalize all forms of abortion. As someone who works around the globe to advance the sexual and reproductive health and rights of women and girls, what is your response to what's happening in the United States on this issue?
Well, it's interesting to see this this evolving in the United States, because if you look at the longer arc of abortion laws around the world, we have to remember that between 1950 and 1985, nearly all developed countries, I mean all industrialized countries, liberalized their abortion laws. This was the time when women, the women's movement, really put this issue on the agenda, and governments responded to liberalize abortion. And as a result of that, since after 1994, when we had the International Conference on Population and Development, poor countries, countries in the developing world, also started to make changes. And since 1994, we've actually seen 30 countries in the developing world liberalize their laws. And these are countries as diverse as Nepal, Uruguay, Colombia, Mozambique, Ethiopia, the city of Mexico, Mexico City itself. And that's because, again, because the women's movement has really pushed for that essential right to be granted to all women. But at the same time, a wave of backlash in the U.S. arose out of the religious right wing after Roe v. Wade, and has exported the idea that abortion is a terrible thing, it should be banned. And that's now, you know, starting to also make its way abroad. So it's interesting how these movements come in waves, and the religious right wing has funded groups abroad. We see it in places like Uganda and Nicaragua and El Salvador, Poland, that have really pushed for, you know, a new wave of restriction. So what we have to look at is the tactics that have been used both in the global north, you know, in industrialized countries, and in the global south to liberalize abortion. And I think these are tactics that the women's movement has used very effectively over a span of 50 years, and inspire ourselves from that. And that, you know, requires documentation of the issues, organizing and mobilizing, taking over public spaces with the call for abortion rights, and of course a long haul approach, because, you know, these are long term battles.
And Françoise, in countries where abortion was illegal but is now legal, can you talk a little bit about the movements that happened on the ground? How were these women and their allies able to change these laws?
Well, I'll give you the example of Uruguay, which is a small country in South America. It's a neighbor of Argentina, which liberalized its law very significantly in 2012. And this was a 15-year battle, and the women's movement decided that that was a priority about 15 years ago, and they started documenting the fact that women were dying of unsafe abortion, were injured also by clandestine abortions, were left at the hands of unscrupulous providers, And, of course, the cost of the health systems, because when you don't provide safe abortions, women end up in the emergency room, particularly young women at the weekends, you know, come show up in the emergency room, and it costs the public health system a fortune to deal with the issue that way. Then they started organizing and mobilizing allies, and the women's movement in Uruguay was very clever to mobilize student movements, university students, as well as trade unions, and of course doctors, and created a human rights campaign. So they interestingly made it a women's rights issue, but nested in the call for human rights. And so seeing abortion and the right to control your body and your fertility as a profound question of equality and human rights. And then they took over public spaces with a very potent symbol. It was a hand, the symbol of a hand saying no. And they had those little, you know, hands on sticks that they would take everywhere, to every march, to every demonstration, to every public meeting with government officials. And whenever someone would rise to ask a question about abortion, all these hands would rise, you know, above the crowd. And so they became very visible and with a creative sense of advocacy. And then, you know, they did this for literally 15 years nonstop, and eventually persuaded and seized the political moment, you know, when the president was supportive to put forward the law. They made some compromises in the law. There was not the bill they wanted, but they still jumped on it and got the law liberalized. And since then, they've been fighting the backlash, because that's the other thing we have to realize is once you liberalize an abortion law, the right wing and the opposition is coming for you. And they've had to fight a referendum to overturn the liberalization of the law. Now they're fighting conscientious objection by doctors. And it's a never-ending saga. So the mistake you can't make at the end is to think, okay, now it's done, tick the box and move on. We need to be there for the long haul, fighting for our rights.
And Francoise, what strikes me about the United States and doesn't get much attention in the media is that the overwhelming majority of the population actually supports Roe v. Wade. The Wall Street Journal did a study a couple of years ago. When you bring these extreme anti-choice bills to the public during an election year, on a ballot, for example, on a proposition, they almost always vote against them. It's when the politicians vote, they vote for these extreme laws. Would you say that that's the same, similar around the world in some of these countries where abortion is illegal? Are the politicians on the opposite side of the people?
Quite often they are, because, you know, they have cozy dealings with the church, the Catholic Church in a lot of those countries, or other religious authorities, which, you know, promise that they will deliver them votes in their district and so on. They are often, you know, we see increasingly corruption between the mega churches and religious leaders and politicians in a lot of the countries where we support women's groups. So there is that, you know. I think, and when you put it to the people, of course, they know individuals in their community who've suffered, women who've suffered, young girls who've had to have recourse to clandestine abortion, and they just feel the compassion that is necessary when faced with a situation like that. So that's why I think appealing to the public and really taking over the public space is an important tactic. It's a crucial tactic, and it's one that I think we've neglected in the United States. I think we got a little too comfortable, and now we're going to have to fight with all our might and make it a political priority for decision makers again, and make it clear that decision makers will have a price to pay for their cowardly votes, and we're going to need to be everywhere. You know, I really think we need to make noise, to make this very visible noise once again, the way we did in the 70s, you know, prior to Roe v. Wade.
Jody, we have had you on the show so many times over the years talking about tactics and why politicians, specifically Democrats, do such a bad job on this issue. Now that we are having a conversation about what we can learn from women who work on the ground in countries where abortion is illegal, what's going through your mind about tactics? What's most effective and what's not?
Well, I think that it's a hard question to answer in the abstract, because it really depends on the situation that you're looking at, but I do think a couple of things are general principles. One is that one of the reasons that the, you know, you asked Francoise about whether or not the anti-choice movement or the church or whatever on the other side of the people. And part of the thing that we have to fight globally as well as in the United States is, you know, anti-choice conservative rhetoric and propaganda on many levels, but specifically about abortion rights, because they have so conditioned people to think there's something wrong with abortion or with women managing their own fertility or with health decisions made by women, that the first thing we have to do is get over being apologetic about abortion rights and about women's health, because Democrats constantly are in an apologetic standpoint. I almost always cringe when I hear any Democratic leader in the Senate, House, or at the presidential level talking about these issues, because they always feel they have to condition their response. So the first thing is we need to start talking about this, and women's groups are doing it, especially women of color groups, but we need to stop being apologetic about this issue. At the state level, we really need to work with people who understand that while they may not make a specific personal choice in any specific given instance, they may actually be in this situation where they need to make that choice. And what I mean by that is that if you look at campaigns like the ones run in South Dakota or in Mississippi or in New Mexico, where abortion bans were put before, abortion ban ballot measures were put before what is generally considered a very conservative state public, a public in a very conservative state, they were soundly defeated. And the reason is that at their most critical level, people do not want to take this choice away from other people, even if they think they might not never make that choice themselves. So I think what we need to do is really go state to state to state to galvanize people. And I think it's instructive that one of the leading members of the anti-choice community said, we cannot win this in the democratic process, meaning that the more that they do ballot measures, the more they will lose because people reject them. So it's these, you know, I think it's a bigger picture as well, paying a lot of attention to who gets elected governor, to the 2018 races, to redistricting and gerrymandering, because that's what makes these legislatures so absolutely ultra, really fundamentalist conservative people.
And the data just speaks for itself. Last week, the CDC reported that abortion rates in the United States were the lowest recorded since 1971. And many reasons for this: expanded insurance coverage of contraception, increasing use of long-acting methods like IUDs and implants, and a decrease in unintended pregnancies. The Obamacare, we've done many shows about that, how people in the middle have gotten hit really hard. But the fact is, it has really helped a lot of women who need contraception. And this, the CDC also shows that under Democrats, abortion rates go down. And New York Magazine had a piece about this and says something like, you know, the Democrats don't frame their arguments in this way because doing so would paint abortion as a, quote, bad thing to be eradicated, when really the birth control mandate is about reducing the number of unintended pregnancies. Jody?
Oh, was that to me? I'm sorry. Yeah, again, I think the birth control benefit is a really critical issue for so many reasons. I mean, most of us who are, you know, when we're in our fertile years, so to speak, we are managing our fertility for years on end, for decades. And, you know, most of us, by and large across the population, want to have a certain number of children, whatever that might be, and not any more than that. And so when you are a sexually active person, whether that's in a specific relationship or not, and you're at risk of pregnancy, having access to effective, affordable contraception is a no-brainer. And it's also, you know, this is what we miss here. Contraception is a critical public health intervention. It reduces maternal mortality and illness. It reduces infant and child mortality because it enables people to make choices about when they can best, you know, afford to feed, economically support a child. It reduces the number of at-risk pregnancies overall. So I think we miss the fact that we actually pay lots more publicly for not having contraception widely accessible than we do by helping it be widely accessible and making it available at no extra cost under insurance plans.
Jenny Jacobs. Francoise, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to add that I think it's important also to see abortion and contraception as part of one continuum.
Absolutely.
Because women have used abortion since time immemorial to control their fertility. It, you know, it is a critical step that women will take and have taken, and it doesn't matter whether it's legal or illegal. Women have recourse to abortion because they best know, you know, how many children they can have. And I also think that while abortion rates have reduced because of increased access to contraception due to Obamacare in the U.S., it's still true that there's probably about 800,000 abortions a year in the United States. So it's not a rare procedure. And one of the things that I think has been a problem is the Democrats and, in general, progressives speaking of abortion as safe, legal, and rare, and therefore suggesting that there will be a time when it won't be needed. But it always will be needed.
Exactly.
And we have to speak about it and call for it, because otherwise we do end up in a situation where it isn't raised in presidential debates until the third debate, as we saw in this election season. Mm. And that's wrong. It should be on the agenda, a very, very visible issue.
Jody, where did that safe, legal, and rare wording come from?
I believe, first of all, I want to concur with everything Francoise just said and didn't mean to otherwise imply. I just think that, you know, people don't understand the role of contraception or abortion in public health. But I think the safe, legal, and rare, if I'm correct, I haven't traced the language back my own self, but I do believe it was made more popular at the very least, if not initiated by Bill Clinton. And it's sort of that Democratic sense, you know, always trying to find the happy middle ground for something, which is not really middle ground, because it does imply that there's something wrong with abortion care, and it does imply exactly what Francoise just said, that you can make it go away, which you cannot. And really, there's, you know, we get so obsessed in this country with whether abortions are going up or down without really understanding who's not getting an abortion that needs one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, abortions may go down for many reasons. They may go down because of changes in the demography of a population. It may go down because of use of contraception, you know, sexual and marriage patterns. But the question is, are there women out there who are not getting abortions who need them? And what research shows is that when people do need abortions and don't get them, they're more likely to be already economically strapped, and not getting an abortion will more than likely drive them further into poverty. So we obsess about these, you know, sort of general numbers without really asking questions about real access for individual people.
Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewire, a daily online publication focusing on sexual and reproductive health rights and justice. Francoise Girard is president of the International Women's Health Coalition, an organization that works to advance the sexual and reproductive health and rights of women and girls around the globe. On today's Your Call, we are talking about reproductive justice and what we can learn from countries where abortion is illegal. Here in the United States, an Indiana Republican lawmaker plans to introduce a bill next month that would outlaw and criminalize all forms of abortion. In a couple of weeks, Texas will require aborted fetuses to be buried or cremated. Last week, Planned Parenthood and its allies filed lawsuits in Alaska, Missouri, and North Carolina against 20-week bans on abortion. So this is what we're facing. A lot of reproductive justice activists say life for women living in Republican-controlled states like Texas and Indiana was bad and difficult before Donald Trump, and it's about to get much worse. So what can we learn from countries where abortion is illegal, and then also countries where abortion used to be illegal and is now legal? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. You're listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or tweet us. We're at Your Call Radio. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about what's next for the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline. On Sunday, the Army Corps of Engineers denied Energy Transfer Partners, the company that's building the pipeline, the permit it needs to complete construction under the Missouri River. But the company says it plans to finish the job. Donald Trump supports the project. So what is next? Many Native Americans say they're not leaving the camp. How are they responding? That's tomorrow. Today, we are talking about reproductive justice and abortion. And we decided that we needed to have a conversation about what we can learn from countries where abortion is currently illegal. Because under many Republicans, that's the country they'd like to live in. Many Republican lawmakers in Indiana, lawmakers planning to introduce a bill next month that would outlaw all forms of abortion. Last week, Planned Parenthood filed lawsuits in Alaska, Missouri, and North Carolina against a 20-week ban on abortion. And in a couple of weeks, Texas will require aborted fetuses to be buried or cremated. So what are your thoughts on this? What questions do you have for our guests? If you work around reproductive justice, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Françoise Girard, president of the International Women's Health Coalition, Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of Rewire, and now I would like to welcome Sharon Davis to the show. Sharon is co-convener of the Abortion Rights Campaign in Ireland, a group that aims to promote broad national support for a referendum to repeal the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution by the Irish Parliament. Sharon is a longtime social justice advocate. Hi, Sharon. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you. When did this ban in Ireland pass?
So the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution was added in 1983, but abortion has been illegal in Ireland for about 150 years. We have something called the Offenses Against the Person Act that was put in place in 1861 that criminalizes women who procure a miscarriage. So effectively, it's been illegal for 150 years.
And how does this play out on the ground?
Well, I think effectively, women in Ireland are living with the laws that Pence and Trump and the like would like to try and bring in the United States, and it's had a pervasive impact on care women receive and really medicalized pregnancy, in addition to denying access to what we believe to be medical care to have an abortion when you don't want a pregnancy.
And so what do women in Ireland do? I'm guessing they have to travel.
Well, if they have the funds,
right,
they can. But about 3,400 or so women traveled in 2015 that gave an Irish address. So that number has come down slightly. About 180K have traveled, I think, since when the statistics first started being kept in the 70s. So roughly that works out to about 5,000 a year. So they go to England, they go to European countries that allow for abortion and get the services there. If they can't travel, they have problems. It's really a challenge for women who are poor, who are migrants. We have a lot of migrants, and we actually had a migrant who was force-fed, basically strapped to a hospital bed to stop her from a hunger strike because she did not want to have a baby.
Wow. Do you know if women are having unsafe abortions underground in Ireland?
We don't have any data on that, but I'm sure that that is, my guess would be that there are probably women who do take extreme measures to end a pregnancy. The Abortion Support Network, a partner of ours in the UK, would have some pretty significant horror stories around women throwing themselves down the stairs, taking bleach.
Francoise, this issue, as we were talking about earlier, really didn't get much attention during the campaign. These numbers definitely didn't get attention. According to the World Health Organization, 21 million women experience an unsafe abortion every year around the globe. 47,000 women die every year from complications of unsafe abortion.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's the 47,000 deaths are the deaths we have estimates for, but there's also any number of women who suffer grave injuries as a result of these unsafe abortions. As you can imagine, a lot of them show up in the emergency room with severe injuries, some of them are near misses, as they call them. You know, they barely make it. The other thing that I think is interesting, if you look at the countries where there's been a real crackdown on abortion in the last few years, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there's a handful of countries that have gone the other way and have restricted their laws in the last 20 years. And what the result is what we're starting to see in the U.S. For example, in El Salvador, where it's now completely illegal to have an abortion, what happens is that when women present in the emergency room with a miscarriage, they're then investigated for whether or not they try to self-induce an abortion. And a number of them are in prison today because they've been suspected of self-inducing abortion, even though they said they just had a miscarriage. And that means doctors start spying on women. Doctors are reporting women to the authorities. And it creates a terrible climate, of course, for healthcare, providing healthcare. Similarly, this happened in Indiana, in fact, you know, under Governor Pence, where a woman named Purvi Patel showed up in the emergency room with a miscarriage and was sent to jail for self-inducing an abortion. The other phenomenon that you describe is with Ireland is women having to travel to neighboring countries, which is what, you know, Donald Trump has suggested we would have to do if abortion law is changed in the U.S. And that's what women in Poland, for example, also have to do, since Poland restricted its abortion laws in the early 90s. Polish women, if they can't put together the funds, travel to neighboring countries, to Germany or Slovakia, to obtain a safe abortion. So that's, of course, a huge tax on women because they have to take time off work, they have to find the transportation, they have to find the payment, the cash payment, etc., and missed time from work. So those are huge burdens on women, and we cannot go down that road in this country.
Mm. Well, we have a related question from a caller. Let's hear from Diane in Oakland. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for the great show about this critical topic. My question, I know we're talking about foreign nations that have illegal abortion, but it led me to have a question, which is, do we have any numbers or statistics on what has been happening in our states in America where fairly recently abortion has become almost illegal or impossible to obtain, as you know, like places like Texas, places where they've closed all these clinics, et cetera. Do we know whether birth rates have gone up or emergency room visits from women have gone up or traveling? Do we know what's been happening to the real women on the ground with these horrible regulations?
Yeah, a few studies have come out. Jody, do you want to take that one?
Well, we know, I mean, some of these things have a somewhat lag time effect in the sense that you don't see the data for a couple of years after because you have to be sure that, you know, you're really measuring what's correct. We know that in Texas that there has been good data showing that more women are turning to abortion drugs and trying to get abortion pills. We know that women are really spending a lot more time and money trying to access abortion care in that state. We know that many millions of women in Texas, for example, are going without care now because they can't get access to reproductive health care just generally. So I will not be surprised if you start to see things like HPV rates or cervical cancer rates start to go up in the ensuing years. We do know that there is abortion migration, if you want to call it that, out of state, just like in Ireland, women going abroad You might have abortion, people seeking abortions going from a state where there are lots of restrictions to a state where there are fewer restrictions. This is happening cross-border in many states. What we've got is women already who are, already struggling to make the right choices for themselves or for their families, spending more money, more time, more effort to try to manage their fertility. And something I wanted to draw out from what Françoise was saying earlier, and again, I think we don't really focus on this very much. The anti-choice movement loves to cloak itself in a quote-unquote pro-life, veneer. The fact is that making abortion illegal is the least pro-life thing you could possibly do, because what ends up happening is that, again, the rate of death and of illness of women goes up. It actually increases infant and child mortality when you don't have access to safe abortion. And also, you have, more generally, lots of problems occurring with, economic issues and all sorts of other issues. So it's a really problematic thing not to look at this in the context of broader public health and of the cost to society and the individual of making abortion unavailable. So it's the least pro-life thing you can do, especially when you're also cutting the Affordable Care Act or, repealing it, whatever they're planning to do, and leaving lots of people without health care writ large.
And Sharon, you're co-convener of the Abortion Rights Campaign in Ireland. You work with a group that is trying to gain support for a referendum to repeal the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. Are you using public health arguments to reach out to people? And if so, what does that look like?
Yeah, so the Abortion Rights Campaign is actually advocating for free, safe, and legal abortions in Ireland. So that's our ultimate aim. To step towards that, we have to remove the Eighth Amendment, which equates the life of a woman to that of a fetus. and so, yes, we are using public health arguments, but I also think in terms of talking about health, we're also having to shine a light on the impact that the Eighth Amendment has had on maternity care in this country. We've had women die from septicemia, from not receiving abortions. Michelle Hart died from cancer because her life was considered to be not under immediate threat, and she was denied an abortion. And so there are cases in Ireland that have, sort of highlighted this sort of dystopian and very tragic scenarios for women on the ground, and have highlighted the need for talking about public health and what this means for maternal care. And I just want to come in on this point of consent, because not only do women in Ireland, as soon as they become pregnant, lose the right to consent in any medical treatment that could impact the fetus. We also have a situation where doctors can conscientiously object, and we've seen that also have an incredible chilling effect, because in rural Ireland, where stigma is somewhat stronger, we've seen women travel to neighboring villages and towns just to get pills and or for contraception pills, morning after pills, which is legal in Ireland, and then potentially not seek medical care nearby if they have a complication from an abortion.
Can you elaborate on what you just said, that when women become pregnant, they immediately lose consent?
Right, because the Eighth Amendment equates the life of a woman with that of a fetus, the woman is no longer in control of her body once she becomes pregnant. So doctors can and should explain what a procedure might look like, but if a woman refuses, we've seen, we have a partner group called Parents for Choice who has been engaged in this issue and taking cases to the high court, because women won't be able to have a home birth, let's say, or they would want to not have a C-section and are forced to have a C-section.
Jody, do you think this is something that we might be facing here in the United States?
We already do. I mean, we've seen women, for example, be kept under court order in hospitals to be forced to undergo C-sections that they don't want. So we already do see this kind of thing in the United States. It's, you know, once a woman becomes, basically women's bodies are public property. And once, you know, a woman becomes pregnant, according to the theory of people like Mike Pence, sorry, my throat is a little bit sore, you know, once she becomes pregnant, that microscopic embryonic organism that's in implanting in her uterus has as much, or really at the end of the day, more rights than she does. And so you have Catholic hospitals that will and have in this country sent women home who are, you know, on having an emergency pregnancy where their life is in danger, but they refuse to perform an abortion because they'd rather see, according to whatever theory they ascribe to, both people die, both the woman and the fetus die, then save the woman. It's really, I don't really know anything else to call it except macabre and creepy. And, but this is the kind of thing that, again, the media does not report on very well. And so people don't see what's happening, especially as Catholic hospital chains eat up other healthcare facilities in this country by buying them out.
Mm. Yeah. Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewire, a nonprofit daily online publication focusing on these issues. Françoise Girard is president of International Women's Health Coalition. They work to advance the sexual and reproductive health and rights of women and girls around the world. And Sharon Davis is co-convener of the Abortion Rights Campaign in Ireland. There is a constitutional ban on abortion in Ireland, meaning that only women whose pregnancies put their lives at risk can have access to abortion, but abortion is not permitted in cases of fatal abnormalities. And they're working to increase support for a referendum to repeal the Eighth Amendment. Today, we're talking about the current state of abortion around the globe and what we can learn from women who are working in countries where abortion is illegal. And if you have any comments or questions, it's hard to believe this is happening in the year 2016, but next month, an Indiana lawmaker is going to introduce a bill that would outlaw and criminalize all forms of abortion. In a couple of weeks, Texas will require aborted fetuses to be buried or cremated. So what are your thoughts about what we're facing, where we are right now? How should we respond? We've done so many shows about this issue, and the laws just continue to pass. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Sharon Davis, again, you're with the Abortion Rights Campaign in Ireland. What is your response to what's happening here in the United States?
Well, I have actually dual citizenship in Ireland and the U.S., and I frankly think it's just incredibly frightening, the rollback of rights, the trap laws. I think there was a Guttmacher study that came out that said like 94% of the Midwest doesn't have clinics to serve the 13.2 million women of reproductive age. I'm very scared because I see, and we work with women every day who face this, and just, you know, abortion is part of reproductive care. It is not something that I think needs to carry the stigma that it does, and I frankly think we need more action on the ground. We spend a significant portion of our time doing grassroots efforts. We're a grassroots campaign. We're all volunteer. We do this after our regular jobs. And it's really about educating people in Ireland. And just to come in on the point about the Eighth Amendment, it actually requires that there's a risk to life of a woman, and because we have something called the Protection of Life During Pregnancy that was brought in 2013 in response to Safita Halpanavar's death, and it imposes a 14-year prison sentence for abortions, which is, and I think this is worth pointing out, rape in Ireland gets you 5 years in jail.
Wow. How many women are serving? Do you know?
currently we have, the state hasn't taken a case against a woman, but in the north of Ireland, and there's a lot of connections between the north and the south with this issue, there are two women currently who have been cited for using pills.
Mm-hmm. Francoise, how do you think we should look at the restriction of reproductive rights in the broader context? So, for example, maternity benefits are dismal here in the U.S. The U.S. is woefully behind the rest of the world when it comes to paid leave. According to the International Labor Organization, the only other country that doesn't guarantee paid leave for new mothers is Papua New Guinea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think this is all connected. You know, unless we start to look at women as full human beings with full civil rights, and that the issues that impact women, like childcare, like maternity leave, like contraception, abortion, and so on, are addressed as a priority, we're going to continue to perpetuate this second-class status, or even this non-citizen status, because, you know, as the other commentators describe, we're really not considering women to be full human beings, in a sense. And so I think we need to look at the full range of issues, like child care, maternity care, and so on. If we don't have those rights, and if our status in society remains low, and if control of our body remains a permissible objective of policy, of public policy, then we're going to continue to see, you know, the maternal deaths, we're going to continue to see maternal injury, we're going to continue to see women of color and women in low-income communities unable to take control of their lives and be safe. That's just the reality.
And we have Donald Trump appointing people with very extreme views on abortion. For example, Tom Price will be appointed as the next Health and Human Services mm-hmm. Secretary. He has a horrific record on women's issues and LGBTQ rights.
Yes, yeah, that's right. I don't think there's a single person so far that's been put forward that is pro-choice, and all of them are also anti-LGBT, so that gives us a sense of what their concerns are. And, you know, I think we really need to look, and it's interesting, you know, when Sharon was speaking about what's going on in Ireland, that you see the links between the tactics that the religious right wing and the Catholic bishops have used in this country and are being, they've been exported abroad, and there's communication between all those groups across countries, and some of the tactics that they've used, like fake science, you know, now everyone was concerned about fake news in this election cycle, but in the world of abortion, we've faced fake science for a long time, you know, bogus data, you know, scientists that are prepared, the fake scientists that are prepared to say anything, such as, you know, claiming that abortion is not safe, when in fact it's one of the safest procedures when performed by competent providers. But you wouldn't know it from the bogus science that's peddled by a religious right-wing group. So I think we also have to be really alert to the fact that the tactics and the strategies and the funding for anti-abortion efforts, and in general, I would say anti-women efforts, is all related and is a globalized phenomenon.
Hmm. Jody, we have just a couple of minutes left. The next 4 years will be grim for women living in Republican-controlled states. It's hard enough to even just keep up with this. What do you think is most effective at this point in terms of responding?
Well, I think the next 4 years and beyond, given, you know, what things will be set in motion, will be grim for everyone in red states, because lots of people are going to lose their health care. Yeah. Lots of people are going to face, you know, lack of environmental regulations that keep them safe. I mean, we are looking at a full-out assault on both science and you know, medical care, health care. And I would just add a note to what Francoise said earlier, to say not a single person is pro-choice. Not a single person they have nominated for anything having to do with anything has an evidence-based perspective on the work that they will do or understands mm-hmm. public health. You know, you've got an orthopedic surgeon who's anti-choice and anti-evidence. He's anti-public health. So I think we're looking at, you know, really organizing at the state and local level, from state to state to state, really putting a lot of money into local information sources, because we have a decimated press in this country, and that is really one problem that leads us to, you know, fascism and autocracy. We've got to get information to people that they can trust. We've got to work with people where they are. We've got to take lessons from things like Standing Rock and really put together local organizing against these things to build a broader movement. And we have to treat it like it's the fight of our lives, because it is.
Jody, here in California, we live in a very pro-choice state, although a lot of women still do not have access for transportation reasons, for financial reasons. We now have Democrats controlling Sacramento. We've got a supermajority. What do you think is most effective for people in California?
Well, you know, someone somewhat kiddingly said, you know, oh, all those people in red states are going to be really sorry in a few years. And, you know, the sad truth is I think that states like California, where at least it seems for now, members of the state government are really taking aggressive steps to, you know, reject things like, you know, having rounding up immigrants and all sorts of other horrible policies that are being discussed. I think it has to be a sort of beacon for what's possible in making sure that people have care, that they're taken care of, and that a productive economy in those states is the best, you know, offense and defense, I think, in many ways. A productive, healthy economy where people are able to live their lives, enjoy and exercise their human rights, and otherwise have, you know, good health care. I think those are going to be really critical things, because at some point, those things are going to be self-evident to other people looking elsewhere.
And Sharon, 30 seconds, since you have dual citizenship in the U.S. and Ireland, what would you say to Americans based on what you have learned is most effective in Ireland?
Oh, grassroots efforts, definitely. I'd echo everything that has been said around that. You know, 87% of the people in Ireland from a recent Red Sea poll were in favor of expanding abortion, and 73% wanted a referendum. And, you know, I think the people want, women want these things, but we need to get out and agitate for them, and we need to get in front of our politicians and demand they represent what we want.
Sharon Davis is co-convener of the Abortion Rights Campaign in Ireland. Françoise Gerard is president of the International Women's Health Coalition. And Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewire. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
On the next Your Call, what's next for the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline? On Sunday, the Army Corps of Engineers denied Energy Transfer Partners the permit it needs to complete construction under the Missouri River, pending an environmental impact statement. But the company says it plans to finish the job. Donald Trump supports the project, so what's next? Many Native Americans say they're not leaving camp. How are they responding? Join us at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.